You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. It's been a year and a half since state education leaders called for reforms to Michigan's zero-tolerance discipline policies. These are policies that were created to try and deter students from breaking school rules and violence. Critics of zero tolerance point to the fact that a disproportionate number of students who are punished are minorities. Ted Roloffs, contributing writer to Bridge Magazine, recently looked into the policies, and Annie Salsick is the director of the Center on Youth Justice at the Vera Institute. Cindy recently spoke with the two of them.
Annie, how long have zero tolerance policies been used in this country?
Well, they began about 25 years ago. They very much picked up speed, though, in 1994 when the federal government passed the Gun-Free Schools Act. So it's been about 20 to 25 years that they've been building momentum.
And what caused the momentum to build? What influenced policymakers to enact them policies and really step it up?
Well, we think that there are a few things. When you look at the way it unfolded and the research that's available nationally, there was a growing fear of young people that was building in the late 1980s. Some of that came about from some documents that were written and some pieces that were published that prophesized the coming of super predators, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. The notion that crime was increasing a bit from young people, and that terminology really stuck. And even though crime began dropping quite precipitously starting in 1994 and has since declined at a steady rate, the fear of young people remained. And it seems that in large part was what was driving the change in policy and practice, and it coincided with also an increase in placing law enforcement in schools. So there were combined efforts on the law enforcement side and then on school policies and practices that led to a very different approach to young people in the school environment.
And just so we're all on the same page and everyone listening is on the same page, when we say zero tolerance policies, Annie, what does that exactly mean?
Well, it's interesting. It's a very good question because there is no one definition of that. But generally speaking, when people refer to zero tolerance policies in the school setting, they are policies that dictate exactly how officials in a school setting have to respond to certain offenses and take away a large part of the discretionary practices that used to be allowed. So, you know, if a young person, they began with the 1994 Gun-Free Schools Act, particularly about weapons and even more particularly about firearms, the notion that if a young person brought in a firearm to school, it was demanded and dictated in order to get federal funding to expel that young person for, I think it was at least a year. And now what's happened, though, is that has morphed and grown, and zero tolerance policies now often include behaviors that are much less serious than the carrying of a firearm and weapon. And we actually know from some of the research that we looked into is that nationally, at this point, only about 5% of expulsions and out-of-school suspensions lasting a week or longer involve possession of a weapon, while 43% are for things such as insubordination. So even the definition of zero tolerance is somewhat changing to include not just the most concerning behaviors in schools.
And Ted Roloffs, for your piece for Bridge, you talked to critics who believe Michigan's gone way beyond other states in punishing and expelling kids. What caused Michigan to get so tough?
Well, they followed up the federal legislation with an expansion of the terms of the gun-free legislation by adding some additional mandatory forms of behavior that would mandate either suspension or expulsion, including assault, verbal assault, a bomb threat, and also expanded what's defined as a dangerous weapon, which in some cases resulted in kind of anomalous situations, like a young woman, I believe this was in Detroit, who brought an eyebrow archer to school, which has a 3-inch blade.
Mm-hmm.
And under that definition of the state zero tolerance law, she had to be suspended. So that's the issue that has prompted some critics to say that the state needs to take a second look at this and give more flexibility back to school districts. But I think beyond the nature of the state laws in Michigan regarding zero tolerance, much of the discretion on how districts approach suspension and expulsion, and just broadly speaking, discipline, still rests within the district. And there certainly are creative ways to come at this other than just, okay, here's the behavior, and here's our rigid response. You did this, you're out of school. And I think a lot of districts are taking a second look at that and finding more constructive and productive ways to look at how to deal with these behavioral problems, expanding it beyond just act and punishment. Let's find out why it happened. Let's include the person part of the act. Let's include the quote-unquote victim. Let's try to bring them together in a more productive way. But I think this is a fallacy that what's called restorative justice maybe is viewed by some as, oh, this is just a very soft approach to dealing with discipline. At the heart of this is the notion of accountability for one's actions. And it takes it out beyond that circle to include the victim, perhaps the family of the perpetrator, perhaps the family of the victim, and bringing in other pieces to the puzzle, including the teacher. So you're trying to ultimately get to a more holistic way of dealing with the problem of discipline. And the results are impressive. The districts that have implemented this in a serious fashion are seeing dramatic reductions in the number of suspensions and expulsions.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Bridge Magazine contributing writer Ted Roloffs, who wrote a piece in a recent issue of Bridge looking at zero tolerance and what's being done to reform that approach in schools in Michigan. And I'm also speaking with the director of the Center on Youth Justice at the Vera Institute, Annie Salsic. Annie, what have you learned in your study that was recently released called A Generation Later, What We've Learned About Zero Tolerance in Schools? You kind of find that it really has not made American schools safer?
Right. So what we did, we work in the area of juvenile justice reform. So zero tolerance policies have, you know, there's not good data that shows that there's a direct causal relationship here, but it's quite clear that with the increase of zero tolerance policies, there's been quite a spike in the use of suspensions and expulsions in schools, and that varies across the country. In some places, it's astronomically high, and others, it's been a less steep incline. But essentially, we know that the number of secondary school students suspended or expelled in 1 year increased about 40% between 1973, so we're going quite far back in time, and 2010. And when we look at the effects of that, we see, based on the research, based on empirical studies, that when you compare similarly situated students in similarly situated schools, right, so similar behavior, similar mm-hmm. demographics, and even a single suspension or expulsion can greatly increase the likelihood that a young person will both fall back a grade, and that's a huge predictor of dropping out of school, which is a predictor for not being able to make as much of an income later. It also raises the likelihood that a young person will become involved in the juvenile justice system. And that is something that we know very close to our heart in our experience, that once you're involved in the juvenile justice system, the likelihood that you'll become later involved in the criminal justice system, that you have unintended consequences that come with a report, with a background check on being involved in the justice system. So on an individual level, we know that there are very negative impacts on young people when it comes to suspension and expulsion, and that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about zero tolerance. But some people have asked, well, that's on an individual level. Maybe the school benefits as a whole, or the young people that remain in the school benefit. And
right.
What we see from the research is that there's really nothing to verify that. So there's nothing to say that schools become safer when they use zero tolerance policies. There's nothing to say that there's an improved school culture or climate. If anything, there's research that points more to the opposite. And as Ted was pointing out, the promising thing is that we're seeing some real alternative practices flourish and become more popular. And while there's not nearly enough research yet, which does not mean that they're not good practices. It just means that we as a country need to resource that research more. What is available for the outcomes in the preliminary research are very promising.
Just to maybe bring home that point, I don't have a sample of restorative justice across the nation and some concrete data to say this is exactly what it does everywhere it's been tried. But the places that I was able to reach in Michigan that are doing this in a comprehensive way have impressive results. And just mm-hmm. I'll mention one. This is a middle school in Macomb County. Talked to the principal there, and he said to me when this was first discussed for the school, he said he was flat out opposed. Mm-hmm. He came kind of from the old school of discipline. Here's the behavior, here's the punishment, you know the rules.
You broke the rules, out you go.
And this is what happens.
Yeah.
Well, they put in a restorative justice program in this middle school, which basically I think they hired two full-time people, trying to get at the front end rather than the back end of discipline issues. If there's a minor incident involving a couple students, they might bring them in and actually just sit them down and try to talk it out and figure out, all right, what's causing this? You know, what are you doing that's causing this? What's the other person's role in this? Beyond that, in a more serious incident, this is where they bring in the restorative justice circle, which tries to bring all the parties together for a kind of a bigger picture view of what's going on, what are the consequences of one's behavior, having the person who's responsible for that try to see that on a broader level. And I jotted down these numbers. I think when they first started it on a kind of a part-time basis, they had 14 expulsions. The next year it was 11, and so far this year it's one. So, and he was fully on board with it after having been opposed to it before it was initiated in the school, and now he's a big-time believer. So I think, and you can find examples of that in other districts. I talked to the superintendent in Ann Arbor, not exactly a restorative justice model, but similar, and they've had dramatic results there as well in reducing suspensions. And I think it's important to look at this beyond the context of simply of a school district and what are we doing within this district and what are the results within the school, because the evidence of the links between discipline, expulsion, and suspension, dropping out of school, and incarceration, you could draw an absolutely straight line, and there's all kinds of data to support that.
And as both of you have pointed out in studies, that it's the minority students who are really being slammed with that. I saw the one statistic, black students are 3.5 times more likely to be expelled or suspended.
Yeah, that's pretty consistent. I mean, the data I looked at in Michigan districts, you had the same kinds of results. It's dramatically disproportionate for minorities.
And some
black,
of the research
Hispanic,
shows,
and
yeah.
even special needs students are disproportionately disciplined. So,
some of the research even shows that when you compare groups, right, when you hold things constant, and again look at similarly situated young people and demographics, that there is disparity in the way young people of color are responded to and treated when it comes to zero tolerance, which is incredibly troubling and problematic for us as a country. And the interesting thing is last week, actually, the Federal Department of Justice and Department of Education issued what they're calling school discipline a guidance package. And there, Attorney General Eric Holder has been very, very explicit about the concerns about disparity, racial disparity across the board in the criminal and juvenile justice system, and how zero tolerance policies have impacted that. And they're quite clear and vocal about that in this guideline package that was just released last week, which is, for our federal government to be saying that when it's not just the voice of advocates or researchers in the field is a pretty big change.
Now, you both know that there are people listening to us talking right now, parents, for example, who will say, well, it's not the zero tolerance policies causing a kid to pull a knife or bring a gun to school or to fight with a teacher. Mm-hmm. It's the kid's behavior. And frankly, people will say, I don't want that behavior in my child's classroom. So get them out of there. So what do you say to that?
Well, I would jump in and say that I don't know that there's anybody in a school or any outside advocate that's going to say, let's make our schools less safe let's not be concerned about violent behavior. Let's not be concerned about guns, knives, fighting. I don't think anybody's saying that. I think the idea of taking another look at zero tolerance is to figure out if there are more constructive ways to deal with discipline problems. And the evidence is overwhelming that if you get ahead of it rather than coming at it on the back end, you can have a more productive result. And ultimately, I think you can have a safer school as a result because you have individuals who are learning from their actions rather than just being kicked out the door, left with many days or in some cases an entire year outside the sphere of school. If that student is not in a school environment for a year or for a half a year, what do we expect might happen with that student? What environment is that student going to be in, and is that what we want? Do we want to ultimately pay for our discipline problems through incarceration, which we all know has enormous social and financial costs? I don't think anybody would say we do.
So, and I would agree with that. I think we, you know, in the work that we do, we're very conscious and respectful of the fact that protecting public safety, school safety, broader public safety is always going to need to be central. But exactly what Ted was saying is that we know there's actually a better way to do that, not just a more, what may feel more ethical way of doing it, but actually a more effective way of doing that. And the other thing that we often talk about is that when you talk about school safety, you have to talk about broader public and community safety because these kids don't just stay in the school perimeter. They go home at night. They go back to their community. And so if we're just pushing out the issue, it's remaining and it's escalating. And the same students who leave that schoolroom who maybe, you know, didn't have the behavior or weren't going to get expended and expelled are still living within an environment in which young people are not getting the help and assistance and response that they need.
If you want to read more about this issue, the Vera Institute of Justice has a report that was released just in December 2013 called A Generation Later, What We've Learned About Zero Tolerance in Schools. And Ted Roloffs of Bridge Magazine, his recent piece for Bridge is entitled Zero Tolerance School Reforms Hit Resistance in Michigan. Ted, Annie, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside today and sharing your insights.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed it.